You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Voter trust in government is quite low, and many might agree that politicians are giving voters ample reason to be distrustful. But what's causing such dysfunction and distrust is up for debate and has been for many years. Some of the politicians we name as leading speakers have also been among the most divisive. Ronald Reagan in the United States, Margaret Thatcher in Britain, to name just two. Mark Thompson, who was director general of the BBC before taking his current job as chief executive of the New York Times Company, deals with language for a living. In his new book, Enough Said, What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics, he argues that language is playing a greater role than we realize. His book is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mark Thompson to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
What do you identify as the key indicators that something has gone wrong?
Well, I can say no more, firstly, than as a listener and sometime journalist and editor dealing with language. I felt that over my career, over my time as an adult, the way language plays out in politics on both sides of the Atlantic has changed. In some ways, the language has got stronger, it's got more impactful, it's got cannier. I think politicians have learned some of the lessons from marketing and the way you can test language with focus groups and algorithms. But I think it's got less good at explaining policy. It's become more prone to exaggeration and to extremity. And although, obviously, many, many things are going on with politics, and I know many people think it's not really about language, it's about underlying policies and about ideology. In my view of the world, actually, ideology and policy, it's always expressed in language, and to try and separate language out is a mistake.
And does it matter whether we're talking about the English language or other languages? Because the English language as practiced in the United States is quite different than the one in Britain. We speak in shorter declarative sentences.
I think that's right. And in the book, I talk about coming as quite a young journalist in the 1980s to New York and discovering a very different a different grammar and syntax in American television use of language compared to the kind of slightly longer, more relaxed kind of pacing and the greater space afforded to news in the UK. So I definitely agree with that. But I would say that if you look closely, and I deal with some European countries in the book, I think you can see in continental Europe, in particular in Italy, I would look at Silvio Berlusconi as someone who, in the 1990s, is using some of the same tricks and some of the same approaches to language as Donald Trump is today.
He comes out of broadcasting.
Very much so.
And
very much
the
so.
Media in general, Donald Trump in a way does, has also come out of broadcasting.
And I think Trump comes out of a very particular kind of broadcasting, which is reality TV. And I was involved in the early days of reality TV.
Unfortunately, the BBC gave it to us.
Well,
I blame the British for a lot of things.
It's true.
It's
true that a lot of the idiom was originally created in Holland and in the UK and then exported to America. I want to say rather feebly, because I do sometimes look at American cable TV with a kind of sense of guilt because of kind of what we create, the Frankenstein's monster we created. One of the issues with television is simply that something which begins as something quite fresh and original, if you beat the death out of it over decades, can become monstrous, and it has become monstrous.
Voter turnout is low and dissatisfaction is high. Don't many researchers attribute that to problems in the political process, the law, the press, and also the public? How is language a problem in all of this?
Remember that the relationship between politicians and the public is very significantly expressed in language. Of course, underlying factors like the economy, whether we feel well off, whether we've got a job, whether we've got access to healthcare, those issues matter as well. But I think a lot of what's happened, and in particular the sense of a large amount of the population simply feeling they cannot trust politicians, is associated with broken promises and with areas which simply show the yawning gap between elites and the public. And if I give you just one example, Most members of the elite on both sides of the Atlantic believe that free trade is a good thing. That opening up economies around the world, allowing the free movement of goods and services, or as free as possible, in the end, stimulates growth, is good for everyone. Decades have gone by without that being explained to the public at large, and we shouldn't be surprised when ordinary people who feel under immense economic pressure feel that globalization and free trade is a bad thing. It threatens them, it threatens their family, it threatens their livelihoods. And that's an absence of explanation. So I think one of the things the elites have not explained enough to the public at large, and as a result, many tens of millions of Americans, and the same is true in the UK and other countries, are turning away towards anti-politicians.
Is that one of the explanations for the Brexit vote?
I believe so. And I'll give you an example. One of the leading proponents of Brexit, a British politician called Michael Gove, in the middle of the campaign, Michael Gove said, I think people in this country have had enough of experts. And that's quite an interesting statement, that. I mean, firstly, frankly, it's...
We've had people in Congress say something similar.
Modern government is a matter of expertise. You can't deal with the Zika virus or monetary policy without...
Or climate change.
Or climate change without deep expertise. But there's something about the language of technocracy, of the economists and planners and other specialists, and the gulf between that and the language of ordinary people, which I think is part of the reasons we have a bit of a crisis. And I think, you know, I began this project 4 years ago, and several of my friends said to me, look, it's very interesting material, Mark, but are you sure this is new? Are you sure this is different from the past? And I sort of feel between 2012 when I started and 2016, I think events are heading my way. In other words, I think that if we look at the Brexit vote and the flavour of the debate in the UK, if we look at the current presidential cycle, I think this does feel new.
Have the experts damaged their own standing, especially in areas like economics with the financial crisis?
I think there's two things. Firstly, manifestly, the crisis, the financial crisis, which was a kind of crisis in capitalism, was damaging to the reputation of elites across the Western world. But secondly, I think that the sense of elites taking the public for granted, not really feeling it was part of their job to truly explain what was going on, to truly explain why they believed this policy rather than that policy, meant that when it happened, there was kind of incredulity and bewilderment on the part of the public across the West, really.
Paul Krugman has talked on the show about how he was hired, the Times thought, to explain economics. And then there were concerns that maybe he was talking too much about politics. But aren't they intertwined?
So my basic view is everything is intertwined. In other words, once you get up and start talking about the future, particularly the way we think of the world now, the connections between economics, politics, foreign affairs, even areas which seem like they're purely about science, so climate change, everything is interconnected, and the trade-offs spread across the entire. If you want better public services, if you want improved, if you want universal health care, if you want a much better infrastructure for America, what's your view about taxes? And that very quickly takes you to the structure of power in this country, the divided federal government, and so on. So, and I think one of the issues is our language, political language right now, is really good at sharp ideological difference, at, in particular, critical, you know, kind of almost like missile attacks on your opponents. It's really bad at helping the public understand the connectivity of everything that's going on.
My guess is Mark Thompson, who is the president and CEO of the New York Times company, he has written a book called What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics. Since we mentioned climate change, often critics say, well, that's just a theory. And then I wonder why they're being dismissive. So is Einstein's theory of relativity a theory? We pretty much assume that, based on everything that we know, that it's also a scientific fact.
So I think one of the things that's got disordered is the role of authority. Who should we believe, and why should we believe them? And how can we stop all of that getting jumbled up?
And perhaps could it be argued that relying too heavily on experts is anti-democratic?
Well, I think my view is experts should be valued for their expertise. But not everything an expert says necessarily speaks to their expertise. But when we go back to climate change, there's a world of difference between a scientific theory, which is a carefully stated proposition about the world, which can be tested and ultimately can be disproved, and a political opinion. And I think the real problem with the climate debate is that climate skeptics treat the considered evidence-backed theories of science as if they were opinions. And they are theories. They may not turn out to be correct, that's true, but they are very different from the opinion, the random opinion of a member of the public or of a non-expert politician.
Politicians often say, I'm no scientist,
but it's the key word.
Didn't George Orwell criticize how ugly and inaccurate language could promote political orthodoxy?
So Orwell, in his brilliant essay, Politics in the English Language, which dates from the 1940s, certainly thinks that a lack of clarity in language makes clarity of political thought and political debate impossible. And his particular fear when he wrote the essay was that was going to lead to totalitarian government. Now, that's not what happened. But I still think that his basic insight, which is that if you let your language slip and the standards of your language slip, bad things follow, but potentially deeper problems emerge in your politics. That still feels right to me.
And that has happened, even though we haven't slipped into totalitarianism. We saw that in all the discourse about the war in Iraq, both here and in Britain.
I think that's right. So there was a period, admittedly and understandably, from an emotional point of view, in the aftermath of 9/11, where a certain kind of discourse about America and its allies and the rest of the world was too little scrutinized, was too little tested and checked. And the consequence, it seems to me, certainly this is felt very strongly in the UK.
And the New York Times has issued an apology for its role.
I think the media, including the New York Times, particularly in the United States, and again, I say understandably, because there was an immense public shock at the attack on New York City on 9/11, the sense of an attack on the American homeland. But we should be clear that the result of that, I think, was in all sorts of ways by the media, perhaps by the public as well, too little scrutiny, too little questioning. And, you know, certainly, I think in retrospect, mistakes being made in the foreign policy arena.
My guest is Mark Thompson, who was formerly Director General of the BBC and is currently the President and CEO of the New York Times Company. His book, What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics, published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue a conversation after this. We're back with Mark Thompson. His book, Enough Said, giving it the subtitle as its title, What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics, published by St. Martin's Press. In This Town, Mark Leibovitz described how Washington has changed with lobbying political consultants, pundits, and others. Is a broader, perhaps deeper change taking place across the United States or even across North America and Europe?
I think so. And I think that the story of marketing, the story of marketing over the course of the 20th century got better and better at using systematic empirical testing and judicious investment in technology to get better at figuring out how to persuade people, how to use persuasive language to sell goods and services.
So that's been applied to politics.
And that got applied to politics. And, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners will know, but, you know, nowadays, even as were ideologically purer candidate as Bernie Sanders was using technology, there's a technology called Optimizely to test which headlines, in other words, which policies perform best on his website. So that if the task of the website was to get people to donate money, they were optimizing the policies, the expression of the policies, to get as much money as possible.
And a number of politicians over the years have been criticized for going whichever way the polls suggest they should go.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it's complicated, this, because, you know, if you go back to the classics and Aristotle's view of how rhetoric works, how persuasion works, it's about argument, logos. It's about your character, the emotional stance you take, ethos. But it's also about pathos or pathos, the mood of the crowd. And an orator who doesn't listen carefully and sense the mood of the crowd won't succeed. The worry is when all you do is listen to the crowd and give them what they want.
Is part of Donald Trump's appeal that his language is so clearly different from other politicians?
So my view, I mean, again, your listeners will have formed their own view, but my view is that Donald Trump, everything he has said is designed to demonstrate to his listeners that he's not a politician. So he's gone out of his way explicitly not to sound like a politician. His language is more demotic. He speaks in these very short, very tough-minded statements, sentences, very, very short. We've got to build a wall. Got to build it. Got to build it, folks.
Believe me.
Parataxis is what students of rhetoric call this style of language. And the classic is Julius Caesar, Veni, Vidi, Vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. And it says, I'm not a politician. I'm not one of those people you can't trust. I speak like you speak.
A study just published in Perspectives on Politics finds that Hillary Clinton's linguistic style has become more masculine over the years. And I guess that's also in response to trying to appeal to a broader audience of people who feel that a woman should not be doing certain kinds of jobs. Although Margaret Thatcher got past that, but her style of rhetoric was quite strong.
It was strong.
And Tony Blair softened things after that's right. I mean, became Prime Minister.
Margaret Thatcher was advised to lower her voice. And with some training, she deepened the tone of her voice. And again, I think that was an attempt by a woman orator to sound more masculine. The point about masculinity being, to some people, it is believed, rightly or wrongly, that means more authority. It's more authoritative to speak like that.
Over a year ago, The Times reported that Clinton has switched to a style designed to seem less detached. Didn't Mark Leibovitz see a striking switch in an interview with her when he was when she was at State?
So Mark has spoken to me and said he once had a off the record conversation with Hillary Clinton where she was extremely personable, funny, self deprecating, very lively, quite mischievous, and this was going so well that he said, well, perhaps we should go on the record. And the moment she went on the record, it became a rather more formal occasion. And I have to say, I once spent some time with her myself and, again, was very struck in private by her liveliness. And I think that's a very real challenge. We particularly with politicians and others who've been in the public spotlight for many years, have been under attack for many years, the danger that they put up the defensive shields, that they stick very closely to a pre-prepared, pre-tested script and don't show enough of their true character is a risk. And I think, you know, one of the things I say in the book is I wish that somehow the political classes and the media could slightly demilitarize their relationship so we could give the politicians a bit more natural emotional space to show themselves.
The Times recently reported that Hillary Clinton has been meeting with many very wealthy donors, even though she's had remarkably few news conferences. I assume the news conferences make her uncomfortable because she has to just talk off the top of her head.
It's possible that's the case.
On the other hand, Donald Trump has been criticized for talking too much off the top of his head.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that in a way, Hillary versus Donald, you're seeing almost two extremes in terms of thoughtful preparation, sometimes possibly over preparation, versus utter informality. And I think one of the interesting battles this summer has been the battle inside Donald Trump's head about whether he's going to listen to his advisors and stick to the teleprompter and stick to the prepared remarks, or whether, to use his own words, he's going to be himself, in other words, to shoot from the hip.
Churchill seemed to ad lib witty, incisive comments, but didn't he, in fact, spend a lot of time crafting his language? Do politicians have the time or inclination to do that sort of thing anymore?
I think that's a very interesting point. I don't cover this in the book, but Churchill, in practice, spent a great deal of time preparing his remarks. And even, I mean, to an extraordinary extent, in those amazing days in the spring, early summer of 1940, where he's just become prime minister, the Germans are rushing through France. There's a total national emergency. He's still spending a lot of time getting those great speeches carefully written in advance. And in fact, I believe that Churchill was uncomfortable generally ad-libbing, though he is very famous for some very witty one-liners. I think politicians who often have very skillful script writers working with them probably do, American politicians probably do have the resources to prepare remarks. I do think, though, that what's interesting, and the reason that anti-politicians like Donald Trump and Beppe Grillo in Italy, I mean, we can see them across Europe. One of the reasons they've got, I think, the opportunity, though, is because the standard language, the standard kind of mainstream political rhetoric of Democratic politicians in most Western countries does feel rather tired at the moment. And in particular, post the 2008 financial crisis, post the unhappy military adventures in the Middle East, many voters are saying to pollsters they just don't really believe that kind of stuff anymore.
My guest is Mark Thompson. His book, Enough Said, What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics, published by St. Martin's Press. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. If the language of politics were doing what it could or should, what would it be doing?
Well, I think an ideal public language would find the right balance between argument and evidence. So, you know, explaining policy clearly, but also empathy. I mean, I'm not suggesting that empathy is a bad thing. It wants to be an emotional connection between leaders and the people at large is very important. But we seem to have lost the. We've either got a very emotive, I call it authenticist, sort of would be authentic style of political speaking, or we've got a rather dry, top down, technocratic style of speaking. And it seems to me that an ideal form of political language combines the two in a well balanced, kind of well tempered whole.
Lincoln was a great orator, maybe the last president to actually write his own speeches. His most famous speech went over like a lead balloon at the time.
That's right. I mean, people could hardly hear it. He said it so quietly that only people close to the platform.
They also felt it was too brief, the Gettysburg Address.
And Gettysburg.
And now it just seems like the perfect speech.
No, and I think that like almost any form of any part of politics, you need the distance of years to judge politics. But America's had many good writers. I mean, John F. Kennedy was an extremely good writer. He didn't write all his speeches, but he was an extremely good writer. Ronald Reagan, interesting enough, was a very good writer. And in those years when he's supporting Barry Goldwater in the 1960s, he's writing, it seems, most of his own material. And it's really, really, some of it's very tough and rather brutal, but it's extremely well written.
And he also seemed very comfortable speaking off the cuff.
In the book, I think of Reagan as the modern Bill Clinton would be in this category as well, as the president with the broadest register. Reagan was capable of mischievous, informal, very man in the street political rhetoric, classic ideological partisan rhetoric, and on occasions, for example, the tribute to the Challenger astronauts on the night when the space shuttle exploded, also capable of a really beautiful heightened public language as well. So I think Reagan, for me, stands out as one of those politicians. Whatever you think of his politics, this is not really about whether you think he was a good president or not, had an extraordinary range of rhetorical styles.
Is the importance of language all that surprising? Hasn't law and its interpretation been debated for centuries?
Absolutely. I think that, the Bible sets us off in Leviticus and so, and exactly what does that mean? What does that phrase in Leviticus mean? No, of course it's true that our relationship with each other in public, I mean, when human beings gather together to debate what's going to happen, is somebody guilty of something, language is our principal tool. And that's why, from 2,500 years ago onwards, people are really focused on it. And there was a time, we've now lost this, but there was a time when rhetoric was regarded, certainly by the Romans, as a more important and a higher art than poetry. Now, it's very few people in the modern era would say that rhetoric was more important than poetry, but that's what they believed.
And researchers now often find that the important issues of our economy, security, even immigration to some degree, although the Times reports less than we would have thought. Should voters be more concerned about language?
Well, I think the key thing is all of those things you've talked about, the ideas, the choices are all expressed in language. I mean, it's not that language is a separate topic. It's not a separate issue. It's the medium in which all politics takes place. Almost all politics takes place. And indeed, although I deal principally in my book with words, written and spoken words, whether it's a speech, often I think more important is the way language plays out on Twitter and Facebook and so forth. But actually, images can also tell a story. One of the dark truths, I think, about 9/11 is that what Osama bin Laden had in mind was a kind of rhetorical stroke, that the Twin Towers represented something about the West, and the destruction of those towers represented the possibility of laying Western values and the Western supremacy of the world low.
But we also have all these images that, like George W. Bush, in a military suit saying, declaring a victory. These are images.
That's right.
And
of course, famously, the banner behind him, mission accomplished. The kind of the silent banner behind him is what we remember from that. And the ironic aftermath of mission accomplished is a really good example of how sometimes very short, pithy phrases trip up the people who come up with them.
Last week, Philip K. Howard, who you've written about in this book, was here to talk about how law can obstruct growth and democracy. Can the framing of law in other language as opposed to its literal content harm democracy?
Well, I certainly think that Philip's, the picture Philip paints of a body of law. This will be true in other Western countries as well, but an American body of law which is so vast that no one can master it or really understand it, and that it inhibits many things, inhibits economic growth, inhibits solution to all sorts of pressing social issues and so forth. And I think that one of the issues, I mean, I talk about health reform in both America and the UK, and both Obamacare and the most recent major attempt at healthcare reform in the UK are impossibly complicated bodies of law. I mean, the British case, the American case is very similar. The British case, by the time the law was published, it had 1,000 amendments. And I talked to one of the leading experts on healthcare in the UK and said, how long would it take a member of the public to understand this law? And she replied, what sane person would even try?
I was thinking about how we've gotten less witty in our political discourse. John Quincy Adams called Thomas Jefferson a slur upon the moral government of the world. But a more favorite one for me was during the 1952 presidential election, Adlai Stevenson said about the Republicans, if they will stop telling lies about the Democrats, we will stop telling the truth about them. He was very witty, and yet he was trounced by Dwight D. Eisenhower in the election.
Well, sadly, yeah, although I think, you know, many of our most successful politicians have had a great way with words, having a way with words doesn't always succeed. Adlai Stevenson, of course, famously, when he lost, what in one of his political losses, said, the people have spoken, the bastards, which I also think is pretty good.
How has the judiciary in the United States changed? Did Robert Bork or Antonin Scalia influence the language of politics?
I think I don't feel qualified to give that an answer, except to say that what's striking to me as an English person, a friendly foreigner looking at the United States, is what is striking and is utterly different from the British judicial tradition is the extent to which the ideological ideological politics in the United States plays out inside the Supreme Court. We have in the UK a tradition of judges being, you know, bluntly above politics and focused on justice rather than a political interpretation of justice. And so I've been shocked on both sides, not just by conservatives, but by some of the liberal opinions in the and the recent example of a Supreme Court justice criticizing Donald Trump, the idea of a judge criticizing a politician in the middle of an electoral cycle would be unthinkable, and they would be I'm not quite sure what would happen to them in the UK. They'd probably be hanged, drawn, and quartered. It's unthinkable that would happen in the UK.
But on the other hand, British journalists have been less. Have made less of an attempt to be objective at times.
Oh, you remember British
newspapers, often you know the politics of the newspaper by the way a story is told. And there is this, at least, ideal of objectivity in this country, even if we can't really live up to it.
I want to say, I mean, I have an American wife, my children, all of whom are now in the United States, have got both passports. I couldn't agree more. I think that the British press, and by the way, if you could, you know, go back 300 years, this is not a new thing, it's got an amazing creativity and life and liveliness to it, but it's always been incredibly partisan and often incredibly vicious. And the high-minded, thoughtful, striving for impartiality and objectivity is one of the great glories of America. But I think that those two things tell you an awful lot about the two countries, that you can't, why you've got to be very careful about characterizing both countries. That I've talked about a more partisan judiciary in the United States, though it's carefully balanced by the Constitution. I think you have a much less partisan media. With some notable exceptions, I should say.
Years ago, I participated in the Cambridge seminars, and the former editor-in-chief of the Daily Telegraph had just written a memoir that had been savaged by all the critics, and he realized that it was just the sort of thing that he had encouraged when he was the editor at the Telegraph, and now he was a victim of the kind of environment that he had helped create. So,
absolutely, and I have to say that often comes as a rather rude surprise. It's the historic power of the, particularly the newspapers in the United Kingdom, has meant that they've often not been challenged themselves.
Mark Thompson's book is Enough Said, What's Wrong with the Language of Politics. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Mr. Thompson is the president and CEO of the New York Times Company. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you.